Afternoon, I'd like to discuss with you the results of some mineralogy and micromorphology work that I conducted on the Mormon Mesa soil in southern Nevada. And it turned out to give me quite a surprise in terms of the mineralogy that was found. So this just is generally what the Mormon Mesa looks like while standing on it and viewing the Virgin Mountains. So the study area, Mormon Mesa, Nevada, is located approximately 100 kilometers north of Las Vegas along Interstate 15, close to Mesquite, Nevada. And it's one of several soils in the United States and in the world that contain stage 6 petrocalcic horizons. And these are highly indurated, massive calcium carbonate horizons that have developed through millions of years. And in this case, with the Mormon Mesa, it's interpreted to have developed over the past 5 million years in this region. This soil formed on the Miocene to Pliocene Muddy Creek Formation sediments, and it's important for the region because it can hold a significant amount of information regarding paleoclimate for the area, and not only paleoclimate, but past tectonics for the region and what it means for the downcutting of the lower Colorado River in that area. In fact, this is the Virgin River here and the Muddy River are both tributaries to the lower Colorado River. And they have since responded to the downcutting of the Colorado River over the past 5 million years that have left this mesa high and dry about 800 feet above these modern floodplains. So the hypothesis for this study is that the petrogenic minerals that are present in Mormon Mesa can actually record processes that are related to soil water movement through these very highly indurated petrocalcic soils. And that's what I'm going to show you today. The methods that we used, I measured 24 profiles around the edges of the mesa, and 7 of these were described and sampled in detail. And those are shown in yellow with the names of the profiles given. We extracted blocks, and in order to do so, we had to use a diamond-tipped saw in order to extract them in oriented blocks to then further cut them into slabs and then into billets to view under the scanning electron microscope. 131 images were used, and 234 EDS graphs were collected with these images. Also, samples from 2 profiles, the Overton and Hell's Kitchen profiles, underwent total elemental, water-soluble elements, pH, and electrical conductivity, along with the clay fraction XRD. And not only these 2 profiles, but I also took samples of the Aeolian materials and the underlying Muddy Creek. So this is typically what the Mormon Mesa profile looks like. You have an upper brecciated, rubbly horizon that is basically the massive horizon that's been brecciated and churned up and mixed with unconsolidated Aeolian sediments. You have the massive horizon that is the most indurated part of the soil, and the underlying transitional horizon that is less dense with calcium carbonate, all on top of the fine-grained Muddy Creek formation. So the mineralogy that we observed in this soil with SEM EDS is predominantly calcite, and this was easily identified with peaks of calcium and carbonate. And you can see the calcite crystals here in this image. All the images that I will be showing you are from the SEM and are backscatter compositional. So the brighter white the minerals, the heavier the elements. So also identified were the minerals, clay minerals, palygorskite and sepiolite. Palygorskite was identified with EDS peaks of silica, aluminum, and magnesium. It's a fibrous silicate clay. You can see the fibers here, intimately associated with the calcite. This is a grain, a weathered grain in that carbonate matrix. You can also see fibers up here. This is sepiolite, which is identified as with high peaks of silicate and magnesium, lacking the aluminum. Both of these clays were identified, were also confirmed with XRD. And what's interesting, and something I do plan to continue to investigate, is palygorskite was dominant in the massive horizon, sepiolite was dominant in the transitional horizon. And let's see, barite was the surprise and was easily identified as the bright white crystals tabular, sometimes ovoid in shape, range from 1 to 50 microns long, and also were mostly euhedral crystals, suggesting that they were precipitated in place. One sample contained halite crystals, and another sample contained amorphous silica here, and it was usually associated with fibers of sepulite clay. So, jumping ahead and giving my conclusions first, the model of the mineralogical development for the mesa is that calcium carbonate precipitated to induration, whereby the dissolution of incorporated grains, the parent materials, and the dust that was incorporated into the soil provided necessary ions of silica, magnesium, and aluminum for fibrous clay to form, and that these fibers actually created a microenvironment that allowed for the transmission of soil waters through this highly indurated soil. And then barite was able to precipitate in these areas of higher microporosity, such as cracks, voids, and in between the individual clay fibers. So I'll show you the evidence for that now. Fibrous clay meal formation is shown to occur in stages 2 and 3 petrocalcics, or 3 and greater petrocalcic horizons in stage 2 pendants. So when you have calcium carbonate that creates an environment increasing the pH for dissolution of parent material grains, or even the growth of calcite crystals upon this grain for pressure dissolution of the mineral, the evidence for the dissolution of these incorporated minerals released the necessary ions to form the clay, such as polygorskite, and that's what you're seeing here in this image. You have a feldspar grain that has undergone dissolution, and the evidence is its highly etched and weathered appearance. Surrounding it, these are all fibers of polygorskite filling in the voids. Right? What's interesting in Mormon Mesa is that 58% of the images showed that fibrous clay was equal to or more abundant than calcite in my images that I viewed. And here's an example of that. All these darker areas are areas of polygorskite, and the lighter is the calcite matrix. And this is kind of a zoom in of an area somewhere in there, and you can see the polygorskite fibers against the calcite. So barite, it was observed in 34% of the SEM images, and it was found to occur in both the massive and the transitional horizons. In 93% of those images, it was located in areas of what I call relatively higher porosity that include root pores and cracks, as shown around here, and along and in between fibers of fibrous silicate clays. Right? And so this region and this image shows areas of higher amounts of, or greater amounts of polygorskite, and that is where you typically would find the barite. Here you have higher amounts of polygorskite clay, that's where you would find the barite. And also, you can see the barite showing up bright white in this image. It was also present at boundaries between the calcite and the fibrous clay matrix. So why is barite in Mormon Mesa? Well, we have some ideas reading through the literature of why barite might form in soils. One, that it could be a non-pedogenic incorporation or translocation from barite at the surface into the soil profile. But I'm going to rule that out because of the euhedral habit of the crystals and the relationship that it has with the neoformed fibrous clays. Also, that it could have precipitated with high saline upwelling groundwater in the region. However, at Mormon Mesa, we have no evidence for this. And also, there are features found in Mormon Mesa that are gravitational features. These are known as soil pendants, and this tells us that meteoric water was flowing and that it wasn't a groundwater precipitation. So the two ideas that I have are that ions are mobilized from dissolution of incorporated detrital grains that contained the ions necessary for barite, so the barium that was needed, and also that dust was available at the surface and was dissolved and flushed through the profile to reprecipitate barite in these areas of higher microporosity. So the one hypothesis I tend to lean towards is the availability of parent materials that contain barium and or sulfate that's needed to precipitate barite within the soil because some research has shown that the solubility of barite at the surface that could be there from regionally exposed playas that provide the source of barite to the surface, along with that dust bringing in the barite or barium sources, also comes salt. And so there's some research that suggests that high salt content can actually increase the solubility of barite. So with that happening, barite at the surface can get dissolved during rain events or during shifts to wetter climates. And again, the euhedral shape of crystals suggests that it has been translocated and been precipitated in place in these areas of relatively higher microporosity. And then I have some images, the shape of the barite, the small crystal size. These are some small ovoid crystals of barite that, I don't know, could it be organic precipitation of barite? But this is going way beyond anything I would know. But I would love to have someone look into. So there is a possibility that organisms are helping this barite to precipitate out where it does, and also because of bacteria's preference for clay, and that we do find barium around root traces. So in conclusion, we find pedogenic palygorskite, sepulite, and barite within the Mormon Mesa petrocalcic soils, and that these fibrous clays form from the dissolution of incorporated materials and from aeolian input, and that the fibrous clay neoformation creates these areas of microporosity and that are large enough for water and bacteria to be transported through. And the barite crystals that are found in these areas can be tracers, possibly, for water flow through these really highly indurated petrocalcic horizons. And so why is this significant? Well, it shows that these highly indurated petrocalcic horizons are within them are happening important chemical processes that are taking place, and that they are not closed systems, they're open systems. And this can cause problems for future application of any sort of dating technique or isotopic work that's applied. So the understanding the mineralogy and looking at the processes that's going on is beneficial into really getting the correct dates out of this. And the location of pedogenic barite suggests that the ions were transported through soil waters in areas of relatively higher microporosity, and that it can be used possibly as a proxy for water movement in Mormon Mesa. And I'd like to thank the financial assistants at UNLV and Debbie and Doug for their help. And I will entertain any questions. I don't know. That's my future work. It was a surprise. I don't know. I don't know if it could be parent material differences. Mormon Mesa's had a very complicated development through time, and what I suspect in some work that I've done on the general features, the macroscopic features, is that there's a distinct erosional difference and a distinct erosional events that occurred after the formation of the transitional horizon, and that there's in fact aeolian parent material contribution with the massive horizon. So if it's a parent material difference, could be, is it a matter of availability of aluminum with palygorskite? In, you know, is it because of parent material? Is it because of the induration? I don't know the answer to that question. Well, barite is found both in the massive and the transitional, but the total elemental for barium that was ran was very, very low in both the Muddy Creek and the Aeolian. It was very, very high in the in both petrocalcic horizons. So, for example, I think it was 100 in the Aeolian, 100 parts per million, or billion, 100 parts per billion in the Aeolian, and in the massive horizon, it was 1,700. So, and that's why I kind of ruled out parent material.
We usually think about soil as something that you pick up from Japan. Would you comment on your concept of what the soil profile includes? In this case, I think it's quite different from what most of us deal with.
Well, because it's unconsolidated, it's its age. It's the age. It's been sitting there for 5 million years, and it's had contributions for 5 million years. And the biggest contributions is from dust and Aeolian input. And as you're contributing, you're changing the chemistry, you're changing the mineralogy. Think of how many climates it's sat there and gone through. It's gone through arid to semi-arid, back and forth, but I think the biggest thing is the Aeolian input, and it's just additions. And of course, exposure, when you go from a wetter to drier climate, you're changing the vegetation, you're exposing not only just the surface in that area, but regionally, you're opening up dust sources for continued input. It's such a dynamic system that for a long time, everybody suspected was such a closed system, and I think there still needs to be so much work, more work done on these to really fully understand what's going on.
Thank you. My main question is why burite and not gypsum or anhydrite?
Well, that's an excellent question. One problem we face, and I hope that is addressed in future symposia and sessions, is proper sampling methods. Because in all my methods, I used water, as we all mostly do. And that's the challenge, because now I want to go back and resample this without using any sort of water and seeing, do I see gypsum crystals with that barite? Do I see gypsum crystals in the palygorskite and sepalite fibers? I would never know that. I would never know if halite was there. So that's future work too. I have a lot of work on my plate.
I mean, barite is much, much, much more insoluble than gypsum. And your idea of dissolving some in the top, I don't like that.
You and probably, I'm sure, many others. But I can't, how else do you explain these euhedral precipitated crystals? Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Any questions for any of the previous speakers before we conclude? No? All right. Brad, before we go off the door.